sin's merciless wave, the strong arm of our captain is mighty, mighty to save. Trust him today and no longer delay, for the old ship of Zion and shout on your come forth.
Joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Make a joyful noise to the Lord. Serve the Lord with gladness. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with the sheep of his pasture. Know ye that the Lord, he is God. It is he that hath made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people. Sheep of his pasture. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Make a joyful noise to the Lord. Serve the Lord with gladness. Serve the Lord with gladness. With singing, make a joyful noise unto the Lord.
Oh, PBC Online, a ministry of Old Paths Baptist Church at Northfield, Minnesota, and we are live here today. It is, 2:16 p.m. Central Time. And we are back here again live, and we are going to be talking about reading from the chapter 50, or from the book 50 Years of the Church of Rome. And I'll be reading to you. It's been a little while since I've told you a story, so I guess I better read to you. But it's been a little bit of time since I've done that. But so I figured it'd be a great time to just jump right in there and read the next chapter of this book. So that's what we'll do. And 50 Years in the Church of Rome, Charles Chiniqui. And then he also wrote a book after that, 40 Years in the Church of the Lord, I think. I've never read that yet, but I think he did. And anyway, we'll talk about that book here. We had a great time preaching out on the streets this last Saturday. I think you probably watched that. Some of you, or most of you, watched the broadcasting live from there. So I hope you enjoyed that. And you know, that preaching is never easy, but it was relatively a tame crowd, to be honest with you, comparatively with what we dealt with before. But we'll be back to those heavy-handed and angry crowds here real soon. Coming up here real soon, this week, no preaching this weekend. on the streets, that is. And then we'll be back at it the following Friday. A week from this Friday is the Metallica concert. We'll be preaching live outside of the Metallica concert. That will be, that is probably going to be pretty intense, is my guess. You know, I'm sure it will be very intense. But anyway, so you stay tuned for that. That will be an interesting time altogether with that, what goes on there. And then, of course, we have the Minnesota State Fair, which comes at the end of the month. And we have two weekends of that. We have 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of preaching. And then the next week, another Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of preaching. And then the weekend following that, Pastor Jeffrey will be here. And it'll be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Pastor Jeffrey will be preaching live from Old Pass Baptist Church. He'll preach our Sunday morning service, and then we'll get out there and hand out a bunch of gospel tracts. And we'll have a song service when we come back, but we won't have any more preaching because we'll be all tired by then. But anyway, so, and then he'll preach the Wednesday night. He'll be preaching that Wednesday night as well. The following Wednesday night. So don't miss that. That will definitely be an interesting time. I'm sure that you'll all enjoy yourselves and be blessed by that and be challenged scripturally by that. And Pastor Jeffrey is coming with his boys, his oldest boys. So you know, we look forward to seeing him here, and he'll be here in about a month. So anyway, you pray for him that all goes well with that and all that good stuff. Wow, the markets have really taken a dip. The stock market and everything else. Looks like they're getting ready. So people are nervous about old Camel. But I firmly believe that Trump is going to win that. Going to win the he's going to be installed, right? Into there. And so we'll see what happens with that as time goes by. That's coming. So, and pray for all the sickness that's going around. All the coughing and everything. We've really been dealing with it in our home. Gideon slept through the night last night without coughing. That was a blessing and an answer to prayer. Silas coughed a few times, kind of intensely, but then he kind of backed. He wasn't too bad. So, you know, praise the Lord for that. But they're getting better, but it sure has taken a while. It ain't happening too quickly. But you pray for everyone that they would get better. We got a lot of preaching coming up. You know? Boy, I sure did make some people mad with that. Trump 3.0. Look at that. Boy, this lady got mad at me. Telling you. She said, She said that I never preach against men's sins. I only preach against women's sins. I'm like, are you sure you listen? Because the problem with society today is a lack of manlyhood. Obviously, the gospel is the main point, but I do know how to make friends and influence people. Yes, I do. Take, for instance, this right here.
Yes, I do.
What causes anxiety for you?
Lots of things.
Like what, for an example?
Anything that doesn't agree with me, basically, or see things the way I do and see the good in things. That I just think that society is lost and just a bunch of hateful bullies.
He's turned you into a woman.
I am not a woman, Jesse.
Yeah, you act like one because you're afraid. You're beta.
No, you're a beta.
No. You're a beta, Michael.
No, beta. You are a beta.
Beta.
I am a normal man. You're a beta man.
No, you're not normal. I could think of many words to call you. Norman is not one.
I'm putting this on the bully list. But I can't work many hours because of my anxiety.
You have anxiety?
Yes, I do.
What causes anxiety for you?
Lots of things.
Like what, for an example?
Anything that doesn't agree with me, basically, or see things the way I do and see the good in things. I just think that society is lost and just a bunch of hateful bullies.
He's turned you into a woman.
I am not a woman, Jesse.
Yeah, you act like one because you're afraid. You're beta.
No, you're a beta.
No. You're a beta, Michael.
No, beta. You are a beta.
Beta.
I am a normal man. You're a beta man.
No, you're not normal. I could think of many words to call you. Norman is not one.
I'm putting this on the bully list.
Oh, man, I can't help it, man. That is just... I can't even believe that's real, can you? Oh, man. I can't... That's why... Now I get why, like, when we're out preaching, they, like, cover their children and they, like, shelter them and that they, like, run the children away from us. It's not because of sin. You know, like, they don't care about sin. They're fine with sin. They run them away from righteousness. They run them away. They're afraid of straight talk, and all these people are afraid of absolute straight talk. So when you give them like straight up straight talk, they lose it. They don't know what to say. It completely messes them up. Like they're afraid. So they run from it. They keep it as far away from them as they possibly can. It's amazing, really. But anyway, it's hard to believe that stuff is real, isn't it? It's like you almost think he finds the weirdest, you know, the weirdest things in the world, but he doesn't really. It's just that's actually the world that we live in now. You know, I had this raging Jezebel last night. I was commenting on something and she came on there. I get like those raging Jezebels, they all find me. All those raging Jezebels find me somehow. And they get super angry with me. And one of the first things they accuse me of is, oh, you hate women. Really? It's like that's what they accuse me of. Well, you just hate women. Really? Like I said yesterday when I was preaching my sermon, I was like, I don't think it's me that hates women. I think you do. Right? It isn't.
I have.
It isn't me that hates women. I want women to be what God wants them to be. And then this lady, oh, you never preach against men's sins. Really? Ask the men of my church if I ever preach against men's sins. In fact, ask all of you whether I preach against men's sins. I mean, I think most of it is a man's fault anyway. That's pretty much what I believe. That's where I go with it. It's like, well, men have to take responsibility for society. Men have to lead it, so it's their fault. Anyway, so I won't stay on that because we're going to read in 50 years of the Church of Rome. We are on, I guess this would be chapter 19. Chapter 19. And we're going to start reading here and you know Chiniqui is going to deal with the police with the priest, excuse me. And we may get through two chapters. We'll see how far we get. But on the 24th of September, 1833, the Reverend Mr. Cassalt, secretary of the Bishop of Quebec, presented to me the official letters which named me the vicar of the Reverend Mr. Perez, archpriest and curate of St. Charles Riviera, Boyer, and I was soon on my way with a cheerful heart to fill the post assigned to me by my superior. The parish of St. Charles is beautifully situated, about 20 miles southwest of Quebec, on the banks of a river which flows in its very midst from north to south. Its large farmhouses and barns neatly whitewashed with lime were the symbols of peace and comfort. The Vandal axe had not yet destroyed the centenary forest which covered the country. On almost every farm, a splendid grove of maples had been reserved as the witness of the intelligence and taste of the people. I had often heard of the Reverend Mr. Perez as one of the most learned, pious, and venerable priests of Canada. I had ever been told that several of the governors of Quebec had chosen him for the French teacher of their children. When I arrived, he was absent on a sick call, but his sister received me with every mark of refined politeness. Under the burden of her 55 years, she had kept all the freshness and amiability of youth. After a few words of welcome, she showed me to my study and sleeping room. They were both perfumed with the fragrance of two magnificent bouquets of the choicest flowers, on the top of one of which were written the words, "Welcome to the angel whom the Lord sends to us as his messenger." The two rooms were the perfection of neatness and comfort. I shut the doors and fell on my knees to thank God and the Blessed Virgin for having given me such a home. 10 minutes later, I came back to the large parlor where I found Miss Perez waiting for me to offer me a glass of wine and some excellent pain de Savoy, as it was the universal custom then to do in every respectful house. She then told me how her brother, the curate, and herself were happy when they heard that I was to come and live with them. She had known my mother before her marriage, and she told me how she had passed several happy days in her company. She could not speak to me of any subject more interesting than my mother. For though she had died a few years before, she had never ceased to be present to my mind and near and dear to my heart. Miss Perez had not spoken long when the curate arrived. I rose to meet him, but it is impossible to adequately express what I felt at that moment. The Israelites were hardly struck with more awe than when they saw Moses come down from Mount Sinai than I was at the first sight I had of the venerable man. Reverend Mr. Perez was then 65 years old. He was a tall man, almost a giant. No army officer nor king ever bore his head with more dignity. But his beautiful blue eyes, which were the embodiment of kindness, tempered the dignity of this man. His hair, which was beginning to whiten, had not yet lost its golden luster. It seemed as if silver and gold were mixed on his head to adorn and beautify it. There was on his face an expression of peace, calm, piety, and kindness, which entirely won my heart and my respect. When, with a smile on his lips, he extended his hands toward me, I felt beside myself. I fell on my knees and said, "Mr. Perez, God sends me to you that you may be my teacher and my father. You will have to guide my first and inexperienced steps in the holy ministry. Do bless me and pray that I may be a good priest as you are yourself." That unpremeditated and earnest act of mine so touched the good old priest that he could hardly speak. Leaning towards me, he raised up and pressed me to his bosom with a voice of trembling with emotion. He said, "May God bless you, my dear sir, and may he also be blessed for having chosen you to help me carry the burden of the holy ministry in my old age." After half an hour of the most interesting conversation, he showed me his library, which is very large and composed of the best books which a priest of Rome is allowed to read. And he was very kindly put at my service. Next morning, after breakfast, he handed me a large and neat sheet of paper headed by these Latin words. It was the rule of life which he had imposed upon himself to guide all the hours of the day in such a way that not a moment could be given to idleness or vain pastime. "Would you be kind enough," he said, "to read this and tell me if it suits your views? I have found great spiritual and temporal benefits in following these rules of life and would be very happy if my dear young coadjutor would unite with me in walking in the ways of an orderly Christian and priestly life." I read this document with interest and pleasure and handed it back to him, saying, "I will be very happy with the help of God to follow with you the wise rules set down here for a holy and priestly life." Thinking that these rules might be interesting to the reader, I gave them here in full. Number one, rising at 5:30 a.m. Number two, prayer and meditation, 6 to 6:30 a.m. Number three, Mass, hearing, confession, and recitation of breviarium, 6:30 to 8 a.m. Breakfast, 8 a.m. Visitation of the sick and reading the lives of the saints, 8:30 to 10 a.m. 6. Study of philosophical, historical, and theological books, 11 a.m. to 12. 7. Dinner, 12 to 12:30. 8. Recreation and conversation, 12:30 to 1:30. 9. Recitation and Vespers, 1:30 to 2 p.m. 10. Study of history, theology, and philosophy, 2 to 4. 11. Visit to the Holy Sacrament and reading Imitation of Jesus Christ, 4 to 4:30. 12. Hearing of confessions, or visit to the sick, or study, 4:30 to 6 p.m. 13. Supper, 6 to 6:30. 14. Recreation, 6:30 to 8 p.m. 15. Chaplet, reading of the Holy Scriptures and prayer, 8 to 9 p.m. 16, going to bed, 9 p.m. Such was our daily life during the 8 months which it was my privilege to remain with the venerable Mr. Paris, except that Thursday, where invariably given to the visit some of the neighboring curates, and the Sabbath days spent in hearing confessions and performing the public service of the church. The conversation, Mr. Paris, was generally exceedingly interesting. I never heard from him any idle, frivolous talking, as is so much the habit among the priests. He was well-versed in the literature, philosophy, history, and theology of Rome. He had personally known almost all the bishops and priests of the last 50 years, and his memory was well-stored with anecdotes and facts concerning the clergy from almost the days of the conquest of Canada. I could write many interesting things were I to publish what I heard from him concerning the doings of the clergy. I will only give two of three of the facts of that interesting period of the church in Canada. A couple of months before my arrival at St. Charles, the vicar who preceded me, called Leus, had publicly eloped with one of his beautiful penitents, who after 3 months of public scandal had repented and come back to her heartbroken parents. About the same time, a neighboring curate, in whom I had great confidence, compromised himself also with one of his fair parishioners in a most shameful, though less public way. These two scandals, which came to my knowledge almost at the same time, distressed me exceedingly. And for nearly a week, I felt so overwhelmed with shame that I dreaded to show my face in public, and I almost regretted that I ever became a priest. My nights were sleepless. The best viands of the table had lost their relish. I could hardly eat anything. My conversations with Mr. Perez had lost their charms. I could even hardly talk with him or anybody else. See, here's what happened. Two of the priests in the ministry ran off with women or fornicated with women. And it was such a common thing that priests, curates, they had to always be rotated around or shipped out. Because they were sleeping, they were fornicating with their parishioners. By the way, that's one reason why a pastor should be married, for the most part. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. What's the purpose? To avoid fornication. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one another, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. See, men and women generally are to be married. Generally speaking. And the reason for that is what Paul just said. Living this Christian life and being a Christian, you are subject to attacks from Satan. And sexual attacks, especially. Lustful attacks. So a man that is under authority, like this, a pastor, a bishop, someone like that, should be married. This is a true saying. If a man desired the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach, not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. See, these men are in positions, and they were taking confession from these women, and they were trained to ask them the most perverted things. They were trained to ask them the most perverted and sexually explicit things. So then you have two people, a male and a female, together talking about sexually explicit things. What do you think is going to happen? By the way, that's why the Bible also has marriage is designed to keep keep the fires and the passions of lust down and under control. And it gives you the object of lust, which is your wife. That lawful lusting. And vice versa. But the aged women, likewise, that they be in behaviors becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, love their children. Women, older and experienced women, are the ones to be counseling and talking with young ladies. Preferably their mother, first, if it's a godly woman. Secondly, other elder women in the church when it comes to things. Pastors shouldn't be hearing those things from women that often. I mean, there's things that pastors have to deal with between husbands and wives, and, you know, they just do, okay? But A lot of pastors get into trouble because they are counseling these women. And they're talking about things. And if their relationship is not strong, marriage-wise either, they can get into a lot of trouble. And even the temptations that are there. That's God's design, and that's God's way. And there's safeguards that are up for that, but in Roman Catholicism, there aren't. So Chiniquy, being a true and honest man, is just, he's grieved by these Roman priests to find out that they're not, that these people are horrible. It was happening often, as we've read in different chapters. "Are you sick, my young friend?" said he to me one day. "No, sir, I am not sick, but I am sad." He replied, "Can I know the cause of your sadness? You used to be so cheerful and happy since you came here. I must bring you back to your former happy frame of mind. Please tell me what is the matter with you. I'm an old man, and I know many remedies for the soul as well as for the body. Open your heart to me, and I hope to soon to see that dark cloud which is ever over you pass away." The two last awful scandals given by the priest, I answered, are the cause of my sadness. The news of the fall of these two confers, one of whom seemed to me to be so respectful, has fallen upon me like a thunderbolt. Though I had heard something of that nature when I was a simple ecclesiastic in college, I had not the last idea that such was the life of so many priests. The fact of the human frailty of so many is really distressing. How can one hope to stand up on one's feet when one sees such strong men fall by one's side? What will become of our Holy Church in Canada and all over the world if her most devoted priests are so weak and have so little self-respect and so little fear of God? My dear young friend, answered Mr. Purse, our Holy Church is infallible. The gates of hell shall not prevail against her. Both the assurance of her perpetuity and infallibility does not rest on any human foundation. My goodness. Let's stop there for a second. The church is not fallible. No church is fallible. And certainly not the Roman Catholic Church. God is infallible. The King James Bible is infallible. The church, nor its the churches, nor its pastors are infallible. And see, that's the problem. They are teaching things that are wrong. Right? They're teaching things that are wrong. So, he goes on to say, it does not rest on personal holiness of her priests, but it rests on the promises of Jesus Christ. Her perpetuity and infallibility are a perpetual miracle. It requires the consistent working of Jesus Christ to keep her pure and holy in spite of the sins and scandals of her priest. Even the clearest proof that our Holy Church has a promise of perpetuity and infallibility is drawn from the very sins and scandals of her priest. For those sins and scandals would have destroyed her long ago if Christ was not in the midst to save and sustain her. See, he's deceiving him. He's claiming perpetuity for the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I just preached on church perpetuity yesterday. In Ephesians chapter 3, the last verse. And that church perpetuity is a biblical New Testament church. The Lord's churches. Roman Catholicism is not the Lord's church. It's Antichrist. Even the clearest proof that our Holy Church has a promise of perpetuity and infallibility is drawn from the very sins and scandals of her priests. Just as the Ark of Noah was miraculously saved by the mighty hand of God when the waters of the deluge would otherwise have wrecked it, so our Holy Church is miraculously prevented from perishing in the flood of iniquities by which too many priests have deluged the world. By the great mercy and power of God, the more the waters of the deluge were flowing on the earth, the more the ark was raised toward heaven by these very waters. So it is with our Holy Church. The very sins of the priest make that spotless spouse of Jesus Christ fly away higher and higher towards the regions of holiness as it is in God. Let therefore your faith and confidence in our Holy Church and your respect for her remain firm and unshaken in the midst of all these scandals. Let your zeal be rekindled for her glory and extension at the side of the unfortunate conquerors who yield to the attacks of the enemy. Just as the valiant soldier makes superhuman efforts to save the flag when he sees those who carried it fall in the battlefield, oh, you will see more of our flag bearers slaughtered before you reach my age. But be not disheartened or shaken by that sad spectacle, For once more, our holy church will stand forever in spite of all those human miseries. For her strength and her infallibility do not lie in men, but in Jesus Christ, whose promise will stand in the spite of all efforts of hell. Wow. So he's using sin and the sin of her priests to prove perpetuity. Here's the difference. I use the Bible and the scriptures to prove the perpetuity of Christ's church. Okay? What was he using? Sin. Using sin. That's a scary thing, friend. I am near the end of my course, and thanks be to God, my faith in our holy church is stronger than ever. Though I have seen and heard many things, compared with which the facts which just now distress you are mere trifles. In order the better to inure you to the conflict and to prepare you to hear and see more deplorable things than what is now troubling you, I think it my duty to tell you a fact which I got from the late Lord Bishop Places. I have never revealed it to anybody, but my interest in you is so great. But my interest in you is so great that I will tell it to you. And my confidence in your wisdom is so absolute that I am sure you will never abuse it. What I will reveal to you is of such a nature that we must keep it among ourselves and never let it be known to the people, for it would diminish, if not destroy, their respect and confidence in us. Respect and confidence without which it would become almost impossible to lead them. So what this priest is openly admitting, this archpriest, he's openly admitting that they deceive their people. They lie to them. They make their people think that those priests are holy men that walk with God. And they're not. They're not. They lie to them. And they teach their priests to lie to them. I have already told you that the late Venerable Bishop Plesis was my personal friend. Our intimacy had sprung up when we were studying under the same roof in the seminary in St. Sulpice, Montreal, and it had increased year after year till the last hour of his life. Every summer, when we had reached the end of the 3 months of episcopal visitation of his diocese, he used to come and spend 8 or 10 days of absolute rest and enjoyment of private and solitary life with me in this parsonage. The two rooms you occupy were his, and he told me many times that the happiest days of his episcopal life were those passed in this solitude. One day, he had come from his 3 months' visit, more worn out than ever, and when I sat down with him in this parlor, I was almost frightened by the air of distress which covered his face. Instead of finding him the loquacious, amiable, and cheerful guest I used to have him in, he was taciturn, cast down, distressed. I felt really uneasy for the first time in his presence, but as it was the last hour of the day, I suppose that this was due to his extreme fatigue. And I hoped the rest of the night would bring about such change in my venerable friend that I would find him the next morning what he used to be, the most amiable and interesting of men. I was myself completely worn out. I had traveled nearly 30 miles that day to go to receive him at St. Thomas. The heat was oppressive, the roads were very bad, and the dust awful. I was in need of rest, and I was hardly in my bed when I fell into a profound sleep, and I slept till 3 o'clock in the morning. I was then suddenly awakened by sobs and half-suppressed lamentations and prayers, which were evidently coming from the bishop's room. Without losing a moment, I went and knocked at the door, inquiring about the cause of these sobs. Evidently, the poor bishop had not suspected that I could hear him. Sob, sob, sobs, he answered. What do you mean by that? Please go back to your room and sleep. Do not trouble yourself about me. I am well. And he absolutely refused to open the door of his room. The remaining hours of the night, of course, were sleepless ones for me. The sobs of the bishop were more suppressed, but he could not sufficiently suppress them to prevent me from hearing them. The next morning, his eyes were reddened with weeping, and his face was that of one who had suffered intensely all night. After breakfast, I said to him, "My lord, last night has been one of the desolations of your lordship. For God's sake, and in the name of the sacred ties of friendship, which has united us during so many years, please tell me what is the cause of your sorrow. It will become less the very moment you share it with your friend." The bishop answered me, "You are right when you think that I am under the burden of great desolation, but its cause is of such a nature that I cannot reveal it unto you, my friend. My dear friend, it is only at the feet of Jesus Christ and his Holy Mother that I must go to unburden my heart. If God does not come to my help, I must certainly die from it. But I will carry with me into my grave the awful mystery which kills me." In vain, during the rest of the day, I did all that I could do to persuade Monseigneur Plessis to reveal the cause of his grief. I failed. At last, through respect for him, I withdrew to my own room and left him alone, knowing that solitude is sometimes the best friend of a desolated mind. His lordship that evening withdrew to his sleeping room sooner than usual, and I retired to my room much later. But sleep was out of the question for me that night. For his desolation seemed to be so great and his tears so abundant that when he bade me good night, I was in fear of finding my venerable and more than ever dear friend dead in his bed the next morning. I watched him without closing my eyes from the adjoining room from 10 o'clock till the next morning, though it was evident that he was making great efforts to suppress his sobs. I could see that his sorrow was still more intense that night than the last one. My mental agony was not much less than his during those distressing hours. But I formed an extreme resolution, which I put into effect the very moment that he came out of his room the next morning to salute me. "My lord," said I thought till the night before last that you honored me with your friendship. But I see today that I was mistaken. You do not consider me as your friend. For if you would look upon me as a friend worthy of your confidence, you would unburden your heart into mine. A true friend has no secret from a true friend. What is the use of friendship if it be not to help each other to carry the burdens of life? I found myself honored by your presence in my house, so long as I considered myself as your own friend. But now that I see I have lost your confidence, please allow me frankly to say to your lordship that I do not feel the same at your presence here. Besides, it seems to me very probable that the terrible burden which you want to carry alone will kill you, and that very soon. I do not at all like the idea of finding you suddenly dead in my parsonage and having the coroner holding his inquest upon your body and making the painful inquiries which are always made upon one suddenly taken by death, particularly when he belongs to the highest ranks of society. Then, my lord, be not offended if I respectfully request your lordship to find another lodging as soon as possible. My words fell upon the bishop like a thunderbolt. He seemed awakened from a profound sleep. With a deep sigh, he looked in my face with his eyes rolling in tears and said, You were right, Paris. I ought never to have concealed my sorrow from such a friend as you have always been for more than half a century to me. But you are the only one to whom I can reveal it. No doubt your priestly and Christian heart will not be less broken than mine, but you will help me with your prayers and wise counsels to carry it. However, before I initiate you into such an awful mystery, we must pray. He then knelt down, and we said together a chaplet to invoke the power of the Virgin Mary, after which we recited Psalm 51, "Have mercy upon me, O Lord." Then sitting by me on this sofa, the bishop said, "My dear Mr. Perez, you are the only one to whom I could reveal what you're about to hear, for I think you are the only one who can hear such a terrible secret without revealing it, and because, also, you are the only friend whose advice can guide me in this terrible affliction. You know that I have just finished the visit of my immense diocese of Quebec. It has taken me several years of hard work and fatigue to see by my own eyes and know by myself the gains and losses, in a word, the strength of life of our Holy Church. I will not speak to you of the people. They are, as a general thing, truly and religious and faithful to the Church. But the priest, oh great God, will I tell you what they are? My dear Paris, I would almost die with joy if God would tell me that I am mistaken. But alas, I am not mistaken. The sad, the terrible truth is, putting his right hand on his forehead, the priest, with the exception of you and three others, are infidels and atheists. Oh my God, what will become of the church in the hands of such wicked men? And covering his face with his hands, the bishop burst into tears and for 1 hour could not say a word. I almost remained mute. At first, I regretted having pressed the bishop to reveal such an unexpected mystery of iniquity. But taking counsel of our very fathomless humiliation and distress, after an hour of silence spent in pacing the walks of the garden, almost unable to look each other in the face, I said, "My Lord, what you have told me is surely the saddest thing that I ever heard. But allow me to tell you that your sorrows are out of the limits of your high intelligence and your profound science. If you read the history of our Holy Church from the 7th to the 15th century, you will know that the spotless spouse of Christ has seen as dark days, if not darker, in Italy, France, Spain, Germany, as she does in Canada. And though the saints of those days deplored the errors and crimes of those dark ages, they have not killed themselves with their vain tears, as you are doing." Taking the bishop by the hand, I led him to the library and opened the pages of the history of the church by Cardinal Baronis and Furry, and I showed him the names of more than 50 popes who had evidently been atheists and infidels. Now, just stop there for a second, okay? 50 popes that were atheists and infidels in their own church writings that say that. Can you believe it? 50. Popes that were atheists and infidels. So to cheer him up, he takes him to the records of Rome and says, "Don't worry, the beast keeps going. The beast doesn't die. right? The beast doesn't die. See, that right there is mind control. And they're taught that mind control because their authority is not the word of God. Their authority is the church. It's the Pope. He's the authority. I read to him the lives of Borgia, Alexander VI, and a dozen others who would surely and justly be hanged today by the executioner of Quebec, were they in that city committing one half of the public crimes of adultery, murder, debauchery of every kind, which they committed in Rome, of Avignon, Naples, etc. I read to him some of the public and undeniable crimes of the successors of the apostles and of the inferior clergy, and I easily and clearly proved to him that his priests, though infidels and atheists, were angels of pity, modesty, purity, and religion when compared with Borgia, who publicly lived as a married man with his own daughter and had a child by her. He agreed with me that several of the Alexanders and the Johns and the Piuses and the Leos were sunk much deeper in the abyss of every kind of iniquity than his priests. So what did he do? He showed him people that were greater sinners than them so that he would think that that sin's nothing. After all, one of the Borgias married his own daughter. Excuse me, fornicated with his own daughter. Five hours passed in so perusing the sad but irrefutable pages of the history of our Holy Church wrought a marvelous and beneficial change in the mind of Monsignor Places. There's nothing holy about the Church of Rome. They admit it. Infidels. Atheist. It's a political beast. Right? It's a beast. Revelation 13. Revelation 17. Revelation 18. All the world wondered after the beast. My conclusion was that if our Holy Church had been able to resist the deadly influences of such scandals during so many centuries of Europe, she would not be destroyed in Canada, even by a legion of atheists, by whom she is served today. It's empty religion. It means nothing. Look what the scriptures say about it. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. From this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now as Janes and Jambres withstood Moses. That's them. That's the priests of Rome, Janes and Jambres, wizards. He's saying, look, if we got away with all that stuff in the Dark Ages, and Rome is still here, fear not. The atheist priests won't do anything to hurt it. The bishop acknowledged that my conclusion was correct. He thanked me for the good that I had done him by preventing him from despairing of the future of our Holy Church in Canada. And the rest of the days which he spent with me, he was almost as cheerful and amiable as before. Now, my dear young friend, added Mr. Paris, I hope you will be as reasonable and logical in your religion as Bishop Plessis, who was probably the greatest man Canada has ever had. When Satan tries to shake your faith by the scandals you see, remember that Stefan, after having fought with his adversary Pope Constantine II, put out his eyes and condemned him to die. Remember that other pope who, through revenge against his predecessor, had him exhumed, brought his dead body before judges, then charged him with the most horrible crimes, which he proved by the testimony of scores of eyewitnesses, got him the dead pope to be condemned to beheaded and dragged with ropes through the muddy streets of Rome and thrown into the river Tiber. Yes, when your mind is oppressed by the secret crimes of the priest, which you will know either through the confessional or by public rumor, remember that more than 12 popes have been raised to that high and holy dignity by the rich and influential prostitutes of Rome, with whom they were publicly living in the most scandalous way. Wait. 12 popes lived with whores? Yeah, just read their writings. It's right there. It'll tell you. I sold a set one time. I probably should have kept, but I didn't really have time to expand that. I have so many thousands of books that if I kept that Roman Catholic set of the history of the popes, man, I got that cheap. Man, I got that cheap. I think I should have kept it. It was rare. I probably bought that thing for $20. I probably sold that thing for 100 times that. No. 10 times that. No. Maybe. I can't remember if I sold it for $300 or $400. I think I got it for like $20 though. I might have sold it for more than that. I just don't remember. I should have kept it. Anyway, he said, hey, 12 of them. I mean, remember that more than 12 popes have been raised to that high and holy dignity by the rich and influential prostitutes of Rome, with whom they were publicly living in the most scandalous way. Remember that young bastard, John the 11th, the son of Pope Sergius, who was consecrated pope when only 12 years old by the influence of his prostitute mother, Mariosia, but who was so horribly prolific that he was deposed by the people and the clergy of Rome? Well, if our holy church has been able to pass through such storms without perishing, is it not a living proof that Christ is her pilot and that she is imperishable and infallible because of St. Peter and her foundation? Oh my God, shall I confess to my confusion that my thoughts were during that conversation, or rather that lecture of my curate, which lasted more than an hour? Yet to thy eternal glory and to my eternal shame, I must say the truth. When the priest was exhibiting to me the horrible, unmentionable crimes of so many of our popes, to calm my fears and strengthen my shaken faith, a mysterious voice was repeating to the ears of my soul the dear Savior's words, a good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth forth not good fruit is hewn down and cast in the fire. Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them. And in spite of myself, the voice of my conscience cried in a thundering tones that a church whose head and members were so horribly corrupt could not by any means be the church of Christ. But the most sacred and imperative law of my church, which I had promised by oaths, was that I would never obey the voice of my conscience, nor follow the dictates of my private judgment when they were in opposition to the teachings of my church. Too honest to admit the conclusions of Mr. Paris, which were evidently the conclusions of my church, I was too cowardly and too mean to bravely express my own mind and repeat the words of the Son of God, by their fruits ye shall know them. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. Now, we're going to take a little break because it's been an hour reading. We'll take a little break here, play a song, and then we'll get back to the next chapter here. Okay? Let's see.
Special one. in whose life I saw God's Son, and through tears of joy, with trembling lips, these words I'll say. I saw Jesus in you. I could hear his voice in the words you said. I saw Jesus in you. In your eyes I saw his care. I could see his love was there. I saw Jesus in you. When I stand before my Father to receive my life's reward, and my soul is bathed in God's eternal, when this race on earth is run, and God sees the works I've done, more than anything I long to hear my Father say, I saw Jesus in you. I saw Jesus in you. I could hear his voice in the words you said. I saw Jesus in you. In your eyes I saw his care. I could see his love was there. You were faithful, and I saw Jesus in you. I saw Jesus in you. I could hear his voice in the words you said. I saw Jesus in you. In your eyes I saw his care. I could see his love was there. And I saw Jesus in you. You were faithful, and I saw Jesus in you.
All right, we're back. Here we go. Chapter 20. The name of Louis Joseph Papineau will be forever dear to the French Canadians. For whatever may be the political party to which one belongs in Canada, he cannot deny that it is the ardent patriotism, the indomitable energy, and the remarkable eloquence of that great patriot that Canada is indebted for the greater part of the political reforms which promise in a near future to raise the country of my birth to the rank of a great and free nation. It is not my intention to speak of the political parties which divided the people of Canada into two camps in 1833, the long and trying abuses under which our conquered race was groaning, and which at last brought about the bloody insurrections of 1837 and 1838, are matters of history, which do not pertain to the plea of this work. I will speak of Papineau and the brilliant galaxy of talented young men by whom he was surrounded and supported. Only in connection, Bidard, Cartier, and others, though born in the Church of Rome, were only nominal Romanists. I have been personally acquainted with every one of them, and I know they were not in the habit of confessing. Several times I invited them to fulfill that duty, which I considered then of the utmost importance to be saved. They invariably answered me with jest, which distressed me, for I could see that they did not believe in the efficacy of auricular confession. These men were honest and earnest in their efforts to raise their countrymen from the humiliating and inferior position which they occupied compared with the conquering race. They well understood that the first thing to be done in order to put the French Canadians on a level with their British compatriots was to give good schools to the people, and they bravely set themselves to show the necessity of having a good system of education for the country was well as for the city. But as the everywhere the good common sense to understand that their absolute power over the people was due to its complete ignorance. They felt that the power would decrease in the same proportion that light and education would spread among the masses. Hence, the almost insurmountable obstacles put by the clergy before the patriots to prevent them from reforming the system of education. The only source of education then in Canada, with the exception of the College of Quebec, Montreal, and Nicolet, consisted in one or two schools in the principal parishes, entirely under the control of the priest and kept by their most devoted servants, while the new parishes had none at all. The greater part of these teachers knew very little more and required nothing more from their pupils than the reading of the ABCs and their little catechism. When once admitted to their first communion, the ABCs and the little catechism were soon forgotten. And 95 in 100 of the French Canadian people were not even able to sign their names. So in other words, one of the goals of Roman Catholicism is to keep the common people ignorant and in the dark. This is why they did not want the King James Bible. This is why they warred against Luther's Temple Bible. This was the reason. Because if the Bible was given to modern man to read, then it would break the chain. In many parishes, the curate was his school teacher, the notary, and half a dozen others were the only persons who could read or write a letter. Papineau and his patriotic friends understood that the French Canadian people were doomed to remain an inferior race in their own country if they were left in that shameful state of ignorance. They did not conceal their indignation at the obstacles placed by the clergy to prevent them from amending the system of education. Several eloquent speeches were made by Papineau, who was their parliament speaker, in answer to the clergy, the curates in their pulpits, as well as by the press, tried to show that Canada had the best possible system of education, that the people were happy, that too much education would bring into Canada the bitter fruit which had grown in France, infidelity, revolution, of education. In one of his addresses, Papineau answered this last argument, showing the immense sums of money foolishly given by those so-called poor people to gild the ceilings of the church, as was the usage then. He made a calculation of the tithes paid to the priests of the costly images and statues of saints, which were to be seen then around all the interior of the churches, and he boldly said that the priests would do better to induce the people to establish good schools and pay respectable teachers than to lavish their money on objects which were of so little benefit. The address, which was reproduced by the only French paper of Quebec, Les Canadiens, fell upon the clergy like a hurricane upon a rotten house, shaking to it its foundations. Everywhere, Papineau and his party were denounced as infidels, more dangerous than Protestants, and plans were immediately laid down to prevent the people from reading Les Canadiens, the only French paper they could receive. So, here's an example. Not only do they keep the words of God, from the people in their own common tongue, but give Latin masses and read the scriptures in the Latin Vulgate. Why? To keep the people dark. But here's the second thing that they do. They control the media. The Roman Catholics in high-level places, the bishops, the archbishops, the cardinals, the Catholic fathers, the priests control the media. So the media does not tell the truth to the people. This is why they were against the Bill of Rights in America. This is why I call the Bill of Rights the Baptist Bill of Rights. Freedom of press Freedom of press is hated by the papacy and by its Masonic coadjutors. And because of that, they stifle it. But in the beginnings of this country, freedom of press, freedom of religion, the right to keep and to bear arms, all of those things are anti-papacy rights. The papacy hates those things and wars against them. So they put high-level people in colleges that train up journalists. And they control media outlets. And they control the message. The only French paper they could receive, not more than a half a dozen were receiving it in St. Charles. But they used to read it to their neighbors who gathered on Sabbath afternoons to hear its contents. We at first tried through the confessional to persuade the subscribers to reject it under the pretext that it was a bad paper, that it spoke against the priests and would finally destroy our holy religion. But to our great dismay, our efforts failed. The curates then had recourse to a more efficacious way of preserving the faith of their people. The postmaster of St. Charles was then a man whom Mr. Perez had got educated at his own expense in the seminary of Quebec. His name was Chabat. The man was a perfect machine in the hands of his benefactor. Mr. Perez forbade him to deliver any more of the numbers of that journal to the subscribers when there would be anything unfavorable to the clergy in its columns. "Give them to me," said he, "that I may burn them. And when the people come to get them, give them such evasive answers that they may believe that it is the editor's fault or of some other post offices if they have not received it." From that day, every time there was any censure of the clergy, the poor paper was consigned to the flames. One evening, when Mr. Perez had, in my presence, thrown a bundle of these papers into the stove, I told him, "Please allow me to express to you my surprise at this act. Have we really the right to deprive the subscribers of that paper of their property? That paper is theirs. They have paid for it. How can we take upon ourselves to destroy it without their permission? Besides, you know the old proverb, Les pareils parlent. Stone speak. If it were known by our people that we destroy their papers, would not the consequences be very serious? Now, Mr. Perez, you know my sincere respect for you. I hope I do not go against that respect by asking you to tell me by what right or authority you do this. I would not put this question to you if you were the only one who does it, but I know several others who do just the same thing. I will probably be obliged when a curate to ask to get to act in the same manner. But I wish to know on what grounds I shall be justified in acting as you do. Are we not the spiritual fathers of our people? Answered Mr. Paris. I replied, yes, sir. We are surely the spiritual fathers of our people. Then, rejoined Mr. Paris, we have in spiritual matters all the rights and duties which temporal fathers have in temporal things towards their children. If a father sees a sharp knife in the hands of his beloved but inexperienced child, and if he has good reason to fear that the dear child may wound himself, nay, destroy his own life with that knife, is it not his duty before God and men to take it from his hands and prevent him from touching it in any more? Well, yes, I answered. But allow me to draw your attention to a little difference which I see between the corporal and the spiritual children of your comparison. So you see, he wants to know the difference. He wants to express the difference. In the case you bring forward of a father who takes away the knife from the hands of a young and inexperienced child, that knife has very probably been bought by the father. It has been paid for with that father's money. It is then the father's knife. But the papers of your spiritual children, which you have thrown into your stove, have been paid for by them and not by you. They are theirs. Then before the laws of God and man, they are not yours. I saw that my answer had cut the good old priest to the quick, and he became more nervous than I have ever seen him. I see that you are young, he answered. You have not yet had time to meditate on the great and broad principles of our holy church. I confess there is a difference in the rights of the two children to which I had not paid attention, and which at first sight may seem to diminish the strength of my argument. But I have here an argument which will satisfy you, I hope. Some weeks ago, I wrote to our venerable Bishop Panay about my intention of burning that miserable and impious paper, Les Canadiens, to prevent it from poisoning the minds of our people against us. And he has approved me, adding the advice to be very prudent to act so secretly that there be no danger in being detected. Here is a letter of the Holy Bishop. You may read if you like. I thank you, I replied. I believe what you say in reference to that letter is correct. But I suppose that our good bishop has made a mistake in advising you to burn those papers. Would you not have some reasons to regret that burning should you sooner or later detect that mistake? A reason of regretting to follow the advice of my superiors? Never, never. I fear, my dear young friend, that you do not sufficiently understand the duties of an inferior and the sacred rights of my superiors in our holy church. Have you not been told by your superiors at the College of Nicolet that there could be no sin in an inferior who obeys the orders or counsel of his legitimate superiors? Yes, sir, I answered. The Reverend Lepron has told us that in College of Nicolet. But, rejoined Mr. Perez, your last question makes me fear that you have forgotten what you have learned there. My dear young friend, do not forget that it was the want of respect to their ecclesiastical superiors which caused the apostasy of Luther and Calvin and damned so many millions of heretics who have followed them. But in order to bring your rebellious mind under the holy yoke of the perfect submission of your superiors, I will show you by our greatest and most approved theologian that I can burn these papers without doing anything wrong before God. He then went to his library and brought me a volume of Ligure, from which he read to me the following Latin words. With an air of triumph, he said, do you see now that I am absolutely justifiable in destroying these pestilent papers according to those principles of our holy church, you know well that even a woman is allowed to commit the sin of adultery with a man who threatens to kill her or himself if she rebukes him, because murder and suicide are greater crimes and more irremediable than adultery. So the burning of those papers, though a sin, if done through malice or without legitimate reasons, ceases to be a sin. It is a holy action that moment I do it to prevent the destruction of our holy religion and to save immortal souls. I must confess to my shame that the degrading principles of absolute submission to the inferior, of the inferior to the superiors, which flattens everything to the ground in the Church of Rome, had so completely wrought their deadly work on me that it was my wish to attain to that supreme perfection of the priest of the Church of Rome, to become like a stick in the hands of my superiors, like a corpse in their presence. But my God was stronger than his unfaithful and blind servant, and he never allowed me to go down to the bottom of the abyss of folly and impiety. In spite of myself, I had left in me sufficient manhood to express my doubts about the awful doctrine of my church. I do not want to revolt against my superiors, I answered, and I hope God will prevent me from falling into the abyss where Luther and Calvin lost themselves. I only respectfully request you tell me if you would not regret the burning of these papers in case you would know that Bishop Panay made a mistake in granting you the power of destroying a property which is neither yours nor his, a property over which neither of you has any control. It was the first time that I was not entirely of the same mind with Mr. Paris. Till then, I had not been brave, honest, or independent enough to oppose his views, though often tempted to do so. The desire of living in peace with him, the sincere respect which his many virtues and venerable age commanded him in me, the natural timidity, not to say cowardice, of a young, inexperienced man, in the presence of a learned and experienced priest, had kept me, till then, in perfect submission to the views of my aged curate. But it seemed impossible to yield any longer and to bow my conscience before principles which seemed to me then, as I am sure they are now, subversive of everything which is good and holy among men. I took the big Bible which was on the table and I opened it at the history of Susanna, and I answered, "My dear Mr. Paris, God has chosen you to be my teacher, and I have learned many things since it has been my privilege to be with you, but I have much more to learn before I know all that your books and your long experience have taught you. I hope you will not find fault with me if I honestly tell you that in spite of myself, there is a doubt in my mind about this doctrine of our theologians." And I said, "Is there anything more sublime in the whole Bible than that feeble woman, Susanna, in the hands of those two infamous men with a diabolical impudence and malice, they threaten to destroy her and to take her before a tribunal, which will surely condemn her to the most ignoble death if she does not consent to satisfy their criminal desires. She is just in the position alluded to by Liguria. What will she do? Will she be guided by the principles of our theologians? Will she consent to become an adulteress in order to prevent these two men from perjuring themselves and becoming murderers by causing her to be stoned to death as was required by the law of the Jews? No, she raises her eyes and her soul toward the God whom she loves and fears more than anything in the world. And she says, 'I am straitened on every side, for if I do this thing, it is death unto me. And if I do it not, I cannot escape your hands. It is better for me to fall into your hands and not to do it than to sin in the sight of the Lord. Has not God Almighty himself shown that he approved of that heroic resolution of Susanna to die rather than commit adultery? Does he not show that he himself planted in that noble soul the principle that it is better to die than to break the laws of God when he brought his prophet Daniel and gave him a supernatural wisdom to save that life of Susanna? If that woman had been guided by the principles of Liguria, which I confess to you with regret are the principles accepted everywhere in our church, principles which have guided you in the burning of Lay Canadian, she would have consented to the desires of the most infamous men, of those infamous men. Nay, if she had been interrogated by her husband or by the judges on that action, she would have been allowed to swear before God and men that she was not guilty of it. Now, my dear Mr. Paris, do you not find that there is some clashing between the word of God as taught in the Holy Scriptures and the teachings of our church to the theologians? See, here's the thing. Here's what they wanted. They said it was better for her to commit adultery with those men than for those men to lie. They were teaching her to sin. They were expecting her and forcing her, trying to force her to sin. See, that's Rome with its situational ethics, with its probabilism. Right, it's the Apocrypha. I'm just reading what he said. It's their sin. This is what they promote. Never have I seen a sudden change in the face of and manners of a man as I saw in that hour. That Mr. Paris, who had till then spoken with so much kindness and dignity, completely lost his temper. Instead of answering me, he abruptly rose to his feet and began to pace the room with a quick step. After some time, he told me, "Mr. Chiniqui, you forget that when you were ordained a priest, you swore that you would never interpret the Holy Scriptures according to your own fallible private judgment. You solemnly promised that you would take them only according to the unanimous consent of the Holy Fathers, speaking to you through your superiors." Wow. So, in other words, what else is the Pope against here? What else is the Roman Catholic Church against? Freedom of conscience, liberty of conscience. Right? They're against liberty of conscience. Never have I seen. So he told him, "You promised and you swore." That you would never do that. You would never interpret the scriptures by anything else but what the fathers say. And what your instructors say. Has not Liguria been approved by the popes, by all the bishops of the church? We have then here the true doctrine which must guide us. But instead of submitting yourself with humility as it becomes a young and inexperienced priest, you boldly appeal to the scriptures against the decisions of the popes and bishops, against the voice of your superiors, speaking to you through Liguria. Now think about this for a second. He told them how foul and wicked before that 12 popes had been. He told them how these same popes and these same men were wicked. They had prostitutes, they had whores, they had illegitimate children, they committed incest. They were drunkards and murderers. But you're to define what you believe by them. Where will that boldness end? Ah, I tremble for you, and if you do not speedily change, you are on the high road to heresy. These last words had hardly fallen from his lips when the clock struck 9 p.m., he abruptly stopped speaking and said, "This is the hour of prayer." He knelt and prayed. I need not say that that night was a sleepless one to me. I wept and prayed all through its long dark hours. I felt that I had lost, and forever, the high position I had in the heart of my old friend, and that I had probably compromised myself forever in the eyes of my superiors, who were the absolute masters of my destinies. I condemned myself for that inopportune appeal to the Holy Scriptures against the ipsy dixit of my superiors. I asked God to destroy in me that irresistible tendency by which I was constantly going to the Word of God to know the truth, instead of remaining at the feet of my superiors with the rest of the clergy as the only fountain of knowledge and light. But thanks be to God, that blasphemous prayer was never to be granted. Okay, that's it. God, you'll notice that God was continuing to shine the light of the gospel onto Chiniqui. He was not allowing him to be taken by that sin, by Roman Catholicism. You know? He continued to work in his heart and his life and suffer long with him.
When shadows fall and the night covers all, there are things that my eyes cannot see. I'll never fear, for the Savior is near. Face the unknown, and I fear what the future may be. I can depend on the strength of my friend. He walks along with me. How can I fear? Jesus is near. He ever was. Over me, worries all cease. He gives me peace. How can I fear with Jesus? Jesus is King. He controls everything. With me each night and each day.
Amen. All right, everybody. God bless you. And you pray for our ministry, please. Pray for everyone to heal. We got sickness that's gone through the church, coughing and such. And just pray that the Lord would heal everybody up through that. And pray for our ministry. Pray the Lord to provide for us and meet our needs. If you'd like to give to our ministry, you may do so by going to sermonaudio.com/Pastor Cooley, or you can go to our website. But if you click on give, there, you can click on PayPal there. That PayPal is salvationpreacher@gmail.com. salvationpreacher@gmail.com. Or you can go to, for Venmo or Apple Pay, you can go to pastorcooley@icloud.com. Or if you'd like to give through Cash App, you can do that. Any of those others. Or you can mail us something. Okay. And you can mail us something to 1030 South Highway 3, Northfield, Minnesota, 55057. All right? All right, everybody. Lord willing, we'll see you then on Wednesday. And God bless you all. Have a good night.